This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Welcome back to The Morning Run. I'm Roshan Kanasan with Noah Lim in the studio this morning. In about 15 minutes, we'll be speaking to Tharma Pillai, co-founder of Undi 18, on the possibility of a youth movement in politics. We've also got a poll running on Twitter right now. Is there enough broad-based support for a youth party? Your options are yes, new faces needed, no, age doesn't matter, not sure, need more info, and I don't care. But before that, let's take a look at markets as US stocks extended a streak of record gains amid rising expectations for loose monetary policy while the economy shows signs of recovering from the coronavirus pandemic.
Yeah, just looking at the numbers in the US, the Dow closed up 0.3%, S&P 500 closed up 1%, NASDAQ closed up 1.7%. In Asia, I think Hang Seng was also up marginally 0.02%, but that can't be said for the rest of the other markets in the region.
Yeah, that's the China was down 1.3% of Shanghai. Japan was flat. Korea was up 0.1%. And Australia was down 0.8%. Europe was also in the green yesterday. And one of the a few notable US stocks that did quite well overnight were, well, Tesla was up. Facebook was up 8%. And Salesforce was up 26%. I think we've been talking a bit about that this week. And anyway, for more on international markets, we have on the line with us Vishnu Varathan, Head of Economics and Strategy at Mizuho Bank. Vishnu, new home sales in the US are up, but consumer confidence has dropped to a six-year low. Is the economic picture contradictory here?
Well, I think on the surface it appears contradictory, but if you think about it, it may not quite be, because the way to read numbers like even the durable goods sales or good orders that came out is that these are relative data that's comparing from previous months. So there could be pent-up demand where we are coming from an exceptionally low base for things like home sales and orders. Whereas confidence, even though there's a certain relative element to it, it is exactly how we're feeling right now. So there's a time difference as well in the data, as well as the relative ground against which it's being compared. And so we may be just looking at different parts of the same picture. So it's not quite the different picture, but different perspectives, I suppose.
So is Wall Street disconnected from Main Street?
That's the devil's advocate question. I'm, as an economist, sitting on the fence between Wall Street and Real Street. I'm likely to say it does appear very disconnected. Because the underlying economic recovery, despite spots of pickup from a very low base, is not convincing or robust enough. However, if we look at the sheer liquidity which is fungible and gushing into the markets, the lack of real economic demand for it means that these end up in asset markets and thus inflating equity prices and asset prices. And we also must bear in mind that at the end of the day, even as we compare across the two, these two are very different because the equity markets and Wall Street is a very select group of companies that's not representative of the wider economy. So things like SMEs and mom and pop businesses are not represented. So we're looking at a very select group.
Yeah, I think if we take a look at the big tech stocks, they represent almost 20 or 25% of the S&P 500 at this point. But Vishnu, another thing that people are paying attention to, a lot of people are paying attention to, is Jackson Hole, or the virtual Jackson Hole this week. Jerome Powell will release details of the Fed's future policies tonight. What are you going to be paying attention to?
Well, I think I'm going to pay attention to any of the forward-looking policy indications. I mean, after all, the entire theme is about navigating the next decade and what implies for monetary policy. And so the elephant in the room really is the fact that a lot of the conventional tools has been exhausted. So the interest rates have been exhausted, and even QE has been stretched to cover fallen angels and corporate bonds on top of government bonds. So the thought here is, what more can be done? And I think on that aspect, what markets will immediately be looking for is any guidance on yield curve control, whether the Fed would adopt this, because they have not eliminated it as an option, but they have deferred the urgency to make a decision on it. I think some of the more fringe one or hopeful ones will be looking for negative rates, but the Fed so far has indicated there's no real benefit to be derived from that.
The Fed is set to introduce a new average inflation targeting regime, or AIT. It sounds very fancy. Could you tell us more what it might involve, and why should we pay attention to this?
I think the Fed has already sort of flirted with this and you know, surreptitiously brought it in previously, because if you remember earlier on, the Fed had made some references to allowing the economy to run hot, given that inflation has been undershooting for so long. And that's essentially the same thing. That's to say, if we've had very low inflation for so long, we can make do with, or we can tolerate inflation over the target. So the Fed is probably looking at perhaps formalizing it and quantifying it in some way, where if they're not looking at inflation just shooting past 2%, and they're saying that they'll not react to that because they're looking at it on an average basis. So the trick here, or the real question here, is what do they mean by average? Is it an annual average or is it a longer term average? And I think that's where the devil lies, in the details of how that is defined.
And do you think there may be a new inflation target rate beyond 2%?
I think the reasonable thing to do would be to suggest a target or a range, a more expressed range rather than a pinpointed target. But I don't think they want to shift that 2% goalpost so soon, because the risk is that they get misinterpreted as if they're giving up on a goal. So I think they'll be very, very cautious about making any unintended signals on that front.
And I think right now, Vishnu, what we're looking at is an ultra-low interest rate environment that is likely, looks like it's going to stay for a while, and some are saying even for the next 5 years. Do you think we could see this go on for that long?
I fear 5 years may be an underestimate, because you know, one thing that we came to find out is that when the Fed wants to raise interest rates, they need to think of a whole host of other things, from asset prices to their own balance sheet, which would be holding a huge and immense amount of assets. So it does appear that we may be locked into a, you know, lower for longer rates environment for a pretty long time, unless something surprises us. And so far, the inflation surprises coming up are the type 2 inflation, a lot on the asset market side, whereas it's not so much coming through in terms of demand pool inflation. So we does look like a very prolonged ride of low interest rates. It's just the real question for us is, what does it mean for credit premium or risk premium? Because when we talk about interest rates, what we're really referring to here is the risk-free or the perceived risk-free rate, whereas the risk premium component can swing about quite a bit.
Could you talk more about that risk-free premium?
The Fed's rates typically, and even up to the 10-year yields, all typically refer to the absolute low rates at which you can borrow, where there's zero perceived risk. But for the average guy on the street who's borrowing, he will have to pay a premium over that. And so the real question today is, how much of a premium do I need to pay over this? This can be deemed to be a risk premium generally, or more precisely, a credit premium. And I think when markets are under very good conditions, everything is flourishing, and there's a lot of liquidity, the risk premium component tends to go down. But under, I think, more of a risk-off environment, the risk premium can spread out a lot more. So even if you have a very low Fed rate, the average person on the street could end up paying far higher interest rates on their borrowings and their perceived risk quotient. So that's really what matters for the real economy, since we're speaking about that.
And Vishnu, let's end on this note. Hurricane Laura is gathering strength, becoming a monster storm, and coastal residents in Texas and Louisiana have been advised to evacuate. Could we see this impact gasoline prices and see them retest new highs, and the impact it could have on oil?
I think we will certainly see some kind of impact. And I think that impact will depend on, and I think it's been warned to be a severe storm, but I think it also will depend on the duration of the storm, how long it makes landfall. And so that remains the unknown. The impact on oil will be mixed, because the refinery area, which is going to be quite hit by the storm, will mean that the crude demand may go down in the US. So that may actually soften oil prices, quite ironically. Gasoline prices could go up. But I think that, again, the impact will really depend on the duration and which part of the supply outages kick in.
All right, Vishnu, thank you so much for your time this morning. That was Vishnu Varadhan, Head of Economics and Strategy at Mizuho Bank. And, that talk around the risk-free premium took me back to university, really. Basically, it's the benchmark in which you look at other returns, right? If the Fed is going to give you a 2% risk-free rate, anything above that is the premium. And how much are you willing to risk to get that premium? And that's part of the reason why we've seen so much money and liquidity flow into the equity markets, right? Everyone is looking for return. Just when we thought it was a risk on, we were going into more cautious territory last year, things seem to have just flipped a switch, really.
Yeah, so I think with the low interest rate regime, I mean, there's always some concerns whether this will lead to mispricing of assets and whether this will eventually all snowball into some huge asset bubble when the party ends. But and, you know, his comments about Wall Street being disconnected from Main Street, but if you really look closely, the markets are really driven by this small group of companies, right? Mainly the tech companies, which you noted. And so and also on the Fed, I think just some forward-looking policies to be looking out for.
Speaking of tech companies, Xiaomi reported better than expected profit after cracking the Chinese market for high-end smartphones and growing its share of overseas markets like Europe and India. Now, the Chinese smartphone maker more than doubled its net income to 4.5 billion yuan. That's about $716 million, give or take. And that was for the June quarter and beating the highest analyst estimates, while sales also increased about 3.1% to $7.7 billion. So they really increased their profitability there.
Yeah, some interesting comments here. The acting CFO, Wang Xiang, he says Xiaomi's overseas business has recovered to pre-COVID-19 levels, apparently. And the company said that the smartphone shipments into European countries like France and Spain actually grew by 65% in the quarter. And so I think Xiaomi's smartphone sales in Europe has really propelled the company to number three spot in the region for the first time.
Yeah, and smartphones account for 62% of Xiaomi's revenue, followed by Internet of Things and Lifestyle products at about 26% and Internet services at 12%. This was based on Q1 numbers. The Bloomberg doesn't have the Q2 numbers at this point. We're going into a few messages right now. When we come back, a look at the youth movement in politics with comments from Tama Pillai, co-founder of Undi 18. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.